fuel debate, as it were. It's been gaining a lot of attention, and so we have four experts sort of in the field of agriculture and fuel to discuss the topic with you today. I will ask that you wait till the end of the presentations to ask your questions, let them get through their speaking, and then I'll come back up and we'll go through the questions. The order will be Secretary John Block. Secretary Block was the Secretary of Agriculture under President Reagan during his first term. Following him will be Rick Tolman. Rick Tolman is the CEO of the National Corn Growers. After him is Tom Baez, the President of the National Farmers Union. And then finally, Bob Dineen is the President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. Mr. Secretary, please.
Thank you very much, Matt. And let me say that I think I come to this podium today from a fairly unique position, having spent a lot of years working in food and agriculture, running a food trade association and U.S. Department of Agriculture, and also have a farm in Illinois. My son runs a farm. We raise 5,000 acres of corn and 10,000 head of pigs. So we've got hogs and corn both, so we're part of this whole equation, and we live it every day. So that's my perspective. Now, the first point I would make is, yes, biofuels have had some impact on the price of food. And I think we can't deny that. But it's pretty small. It's hard to figure out exactly what it is, 10%, 15% of the total change in the price of food. But there are other factors. This is a very complicated issue. And if you just look at the world, the price of food is up. And you pick up the paper, and every day there's a story about hungry people, and food's expensive in a lot of countries. Well, a lot of countries they're spending about 50% of their household income on food, whereas we're fortunate here. We spend about less than 10%. So you look at the world and what's going on over there, and the demand for food is escalating. China and India and other countries are developing, and they want animal protein. They're not satisfied just eating rice or wheat. So that's a big demand right there. I dare say we would not even be standing up here now if the price of oil was $20 a barrel, but it's not. It's $120, and it's likely to stay up in that range or come down some or go up. I don't know. But it's going to stay high, and it puts us into a position we had not been in before, and we're trying to find the future from this point of view. The next point I would make is the weather problems around the world. You've read about all of them, the drought in Australia and other countries. These are big, important considerations. And the next point I make is a speculation. The stock market goes down, so money flows into commodities. Commodities go up. Are they higher than they're really worth? I don't know. But certainly there's a lot of money been poured into commodities. And the next point I would make is the weakness of the dollar. And I was looking at the Wall Street Journal just this week, and you can see on a graph that they had there that the dollar's relationship to the euro. If the dollar was as strong as the euro, we could buy oil as cheap as they could buy it with a euro. With a euro, they buy oil for $70 a barrel, or 70 euros a barrel, but we're spending $120 a barrel. The point is that the dollar situation has impacted things too. And now we have countries in other parts of the world that had not before, but they're starting to restrict the sale of commodities that they think are important. Whether it's rice or wheat, they're restricting those sales, and that disrupts the flow of product around the world. There's a whole bunch of things happening out there, and they're a lot more complicated and making a lot more difference in biofuels. So I guess I would say it's unreasonable to blame biofuels for a big part of this. I would say that, especially internationally, because we are not shorting the market on grain, we are exporting more grain than we ever have in history, $100 billion worth of product, U.S. farm products, going overseas, a record. And if we're sending it all over there. You know, there's something else at play here that's caused the food prices to go up in these other countries. There is a positive side to this, and the positive side is that higher prices equal investment in the industry, and that equals more food. And I will assure you, it won't happen overnight, but in a year or two or three, whatever, over time, with good prices for farm products, the world is going to produce more farm products. And I would just mention an article that was in the Post day before yesterday, I think. Anyway, part of it was about Mauritania, poor country in Africa. And 15 years ago, they were going to they were going to use irrigation on a large chunk of land in the southern part of the country. And with the irrigation, they'd raise more food. Well, it all fell through over those 15 years. It didn't work. Now they're going to do it. And countries will be doing that all over the world, things like that to increase food production. Genetic engineering, that is going to be accepted in places where it wouldn't have been accepted before, because there's becoming a realization that, you know, we need to use the technology at hand, whether it's biotechnology, hybrid seed corn, or irrigation in places. These are all positive things to deal with the challenges that we face today. We depend, I believe that given the situation, that biofuels have a place, an important place at this point in time, and right now we're talking about corn and other products to make biofuels, but it's not too long off. 2, 3, 4, 5 years, we'll be using cellulosic material to make biofuels. All of this is homegrown. It makes jobs for us right here in the United States, and it's a clean fuel. Those are good, positive things. So that's only a part of our effort to deal with the energy challenges that we face today, but an important part of it. And that's not to deny that we should not look to wind and sun and coal. I don't care. We need to look about everything we can find to deal with this problem of trying to get the energy that we need and the world needs today. And that concludes my remarks. I just want you to say, understand that my remarks or my position as a farmer and as someone that's dealt with agriculture all my life, I'm not owned by anybody, and I'm not up here representing anybody. I'm representing Block Farms and John Block. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Rick Tolman with the National Corn Growers. You know, last week it was a very entertaining event, the NFL Draft, something I enjoy watching, where you get a lot of disinformation and misinformation on purpose in order to confuse who's going to draft who. It's the old classic PR strategy of turning little Bo Peep into the axe murderer. And we have a lot of that going on in the national media with corn and corn prices and ethanol. In fact, this article in the Washington Post today is the latest classic example of that, where there's a lot of misinformation, slanted information that's just inaccurate. What I'm going to do is just share a few basic facts about corn and corn supply. There's some real misuse, people that think they're experts about corn. And I think while we do have some role in higher food prices in the corn industry, we're certainly closer to little Bo Peep than we are the axe murderer. Corn is our largest crop. We've been producing corn in this continent for 400 years. It was our first major export back to Mother England. We typically supply about 65 to 75% of world trade in corn out of the United States. We have a comparative advantage in corn production. We continue to produce more on fewer acres with fewer inputs. The kind of corn that we produce that we're talking about that goes into ethanol is not the corn that you eat. And a lot of people miss this. It's not corn on the cob. It's not the creamed corn. Those are two different supply channels. Last year, we had 85 million harvested acres of field corn, and we had produced 13.1 billion bushels or 366 million tons, valued at about $52 billion. On the wheat corn side, it was 631,000 acres, valued at about $1 billion. Those are very separate chains, very separate varieties, and people get those mixed up. So, we produced a record crop last year by a wide margin. Here's how it was used. We had available a little over 14 billion bushels because of our carry-in. And again, a bushel is equivalent to about a large bag of dog food, if you want to get a visual image. 42% of that we had available went for livestock feed. 9% went for direct human consumption. 22% went for ethanol. 17% was exported, and we had a 10% carryover. So those simple numbers, I think, should address a little bit of the misinformation, the axe murder concept. The value of ethanol that we use is not 30 or 40 or 50% of our production, as I hear. It is under 25%. It was 22% last year. We projected out to 2015 when the cap hits on the renewable fuel standard at 15 billion gallons, and we can see no more than 27% of our corn crop ever going for ethanol use. So those numbers are greatly inflated. Another one is that we're taking corn away from the food supply to go into ethanol. The reality is that we will have record exports this year of corn, more than we've ever exported before this year. We are putting more corn in the food supply than we've ever done before, and also adding 1.3 billion bushels for ethanol export. Now, how do we do that? That's because we have growing yields. We have growing productivity. Let me give you a few numbers here. 1967, we had an average yield, national average yields of 80 bushels to the acre. 1977, 10 years later, it was 91. 1987, 10 years later, 120. 1997, 127. Last year, 151. So our corn yields have doubled in the last 40 years using less inputs. We expect them to double again in the next 20 years. Why is that happening? Because of biotechnology, because of improvements in corn breeding, because of the sequencing of the corn genome. We have much more technology to put the traits in that give us yield enhancement. And again, we're doing that with fewer inputs. In the Washington Post, they had a couple of significant errors, one saying that the yield or the acres that we had last year was a record. It was not a record. We have exceeded that number many times in the past. They also had a nice graphic in there about if you fill up your SUV, it requires enough corn to feed somebody for a year, and that one's been out there for a long time. I don't know if any of you have ever bothered to calculate that, but that's about 5 bushels of corn coming out of the food supply. When that statistic first came out, corn was selling for $2 a bushel, so that at a $10 equivalent. Today, corn's selling for around $5 a bushel, so that's 5 times 5, $25. It seems not very much reality to me that somebody could live for $25 a year. The reality is, again, that those are not competing with each other. 10% of our corn supply goes for food use. We put more into food. We use more than export. It's not as if you didn't put it into ethanol, somebody would get it to eat. They are not competing. They're different channels, different ways to use things. Now, what about those comments about corn driving up the price of food? Certainly, higher corn prices have had an impact on retail food prices. Most studies indicate that somewhere in the range of a quarter to a third of what we've seen prices go up. Well, where's the other three-quarters of the other two-thirds coming from? Is corn Bo Peep or the axe murderer? We've seen the headlines. The reality, some of you have the studies. USDA said corn prices pass through to the retail rate at less than 10% of the corn price change. Another study says that every dollar increase in a bushel of corn, dollar increase in the gallon of gas, the increase in gas has twice the impact on retail food prices that the increase in a bushel of corn. Texas A&M, in a report released this month, said higher corn prices have had very little impact on consumer food prices. Well, how can this be? You know, it's interesting to look at how much corn is in food, the reality of it. USDA estimates that our average corn price this year will be somewhere over $4 a bushel. And again, you're seeing 5 or 6 now. But farmers, what the farmer gets is somewhere on the average about $4 a bushel because of forward contracting. Last year it was just a little over $3 a bushel. There's 56 pounds of corn in a bushel. And at $3 a bushel, that's 5.3 cents a pound. At $4, that's 7.1 cents. If you want to go to $5, that's 8.9 cents a pound. And at $6, that's 10.7 cents. So if you looked at common items that use corn, a pound of beef takes 2.8 pounds. To produce of corn, 2.8 pounds of corn produce a pound of beef. So at $3 a bushel, there's 15 cents worth of corn in a pound of beef. At $4 a bushel, there's 19 cents, and one at 4 cents. For milk, it takes 1.8 pounds to make a gallon of milk. At $3 a bushel, there's 9 cents worth of corn in a gallon of milk. And at $4, there's 13 cents. corn flakes. It takes 10 ounces of corn to produce a box of corn flakes that sells for over $3. There's 0.3 cents. There's a 3.3 cents in that box of corn flakes of corn at $3. When it goes up to $4, it's 7/10 of a cent up. It goes to 4 cents worth of corn. So at the retail level, higher corn prices at the farm gate have very little impact on retail food prices. 19 cents of the food dollar today goes back to the farmer. In 1959, it was 41%. Today, 80% of the food dollar is driven by labor cost and rising energy cost. It does not go to the farmer. In 2003, the price of corn was $2.50 a bushel, and the price of oil a barrel was $10. Today, the price of corn for a bushel is just over $5, and you know what oil has done. It peaked at $120 last week. So there's been a very significant increase in oil. That's where the impact is coming. Corn prices do have a marginal impact on the retail price of food, but only by a small amount. What do corn prices have to do with food riots in China and Pakistan and India over rice? Absolutely nothing. There is no connection to rice production around the world with biofuels or corn in the United States. No connection at all. Absolutely none. Bottom line, there's been a very clever marketing disinformation campaign directed at biofuels by those with deep pockets. If you want to know who the real axe murderer is, that's slashing our grocery food budget, look at $4 a gallon gasoline, look at $120 a barrel oil. 38 of the 47 poorest countries in the nation are net oil importers. 25 import all their oil. The Energy Information Association Agency, estimated that OPEC has increased by a factor of 5 their revenue since 2003. Where has that money come from? It's come from poor people who need to pay for food. Thank you.
I'm Tom Bias, president of the National Farmers Union and a farmer from Putnam County in Indiana. It's great to be here. I echo the comments by Secretary Block. I think he laid out very accurately what's really causing food price increases. I get a little disturbed when I read in the media some of the things that ethanol and American farmers have been blamed for. I don't mind having a legitimate debate about the policy direction that we go in this country on renewable energy, because I think it's a positive. We should have done that 30 years ago. We would be much further down the road than we are today. But I do want to straighten out some of the facts. In the past year, we've been blamed for tortilla protests in Mexico. And the facts are tortillas are made out of white corn, not yellow field corn that we produce here in the United States. And our trade agreements actually prevent us from providing more than 2% of Mexico's white meat, corn needs. Their problem was a result of weather-related production problems in their own country and from their other suppliers around the world, not corn ethanol in the United States. Second thing, right before the biggest beer-drinking holiday in the United States, last 4th of July, the beer breweries came out and they were blaming raising beer prices on corn. Well, as I told you, I'm an Indiana farmer, and I do know that in some parts of the state they turn corn into drinking spirits, but it's not beer. Beer is made out of rice and barley, not corn. Third one was protests in Italy over pasta, and they were blaming American farmers shifting production into corn. Well, pasta is made out of durum wheat, and durum wheat is a specialty wheat that's only grown in the microclimates of the northern tier of states, North Dakota, Montana, Canada. That's not corn country. It's not soybean country. And durum wheat is usually a higher value product that they could make more money off of in the second place. Rice. Recently, we were blamed for this run on rice at these wholesale clubs, Costco and Sam's Club. According to the facts, we have plenty of rice. These were two specialty rices, one from Thailand and one from India, where their own countries restricted their exports of rice to help stop the tremendous price increases of food, which are actually, as Secretary Block pointed out, the function of oil and energy prices. If you stop and you look at how far food travels from the farm to the grocery store or to the restaurant, it's over 1,000 miles. You do the math with $4.50 a gallon diesel fuel trucking these products around the country, and you'll find out just where the culprit is. The other factors that no one wants to talk about is the weakness of the dollar. And if you go back to when we went off the gold standard under President Nixon's administration many years ago, whenever you have a weak dollar, you have high commodity prices, whether it's oil, gasoline, gold, silver, corn, rice, you name it. And that's because investors put their money in there to hedge against inflation. So the big macroeconomic issue of the weakness of the dollar, for a variety of reasons, combined with the people who own our dollars, who are taking those cheap dollars and purchasing our commodities to export back to their countries, has had a tremendous impact. The other thing I wanted to touch on briefly is the tremendous investment by Wall Street into the futures market. Recently, there was a hearing at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. There's a lot of concern about the speculative nature of the futures markets. And while some will say, well, aren't you in favor of higher prices for farmers that's driven by this speculation? Well, we're always in favor of a farmer making a profit from the marketplace. But what has happened, the speculation has been so tremendous that it has taken away the one marketing tool that U.S. farmers have used forever to be able to forward price their commodities after they've harvested it. And that means a lot. And I know it's a little technical, but farmers today are paying these record input costs to plant their crop, and they're not having the tool that they've always used to be able to offset and protect their financial risk by being able to sell that commodity at these higher prices. So we're rolling the dice, basically, that these prices will be there after harvest. Crop's just going in the field, and it's many months before that happens. And if the nouveau investment of the day suddenly becomes something other than commodity futures, you're going to see a bubble burst, not unlike the credit bubble and the mortgage crisis bubble, but this bubble will be on the production of food, fiber, and put many farmers at risk. The last thing I'd want to point out, and I think it's in your packets, we do a monthly thing called this Farmer's Share of the Retail Dollar. And as was pointed out, about less than 20 cents of that food dollar goes to farmers. 80% goes to other people for processing, transportation, distribution, storage, retailing. And the share that the farmer receives is minuscule. There was a story this past week that was lamenting about the price of bagels might be going over a dollar each in Bethesda, Maryland. Bethesda, Maryland is a fairly high-income area in this part of town. So I checked. How much of that hard red winter wheat, I think it's red winter wheat, in North Dakota, because they talked about North Dakota wheat prices, how much of that is in a bagel? That $1 bagel is 7 cents worth of wheat. 7 cents worth of wheat. So if you want to point the finger at why we have high food prices, it's not those raw commodity prices on the farm that are the biggest culprit in the game. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. My name is My name is Bob Dineen. I am President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. As you've already heard, the list of factors influencing the price of food is long, and it includes the skyrocketing price of oil, gasoline, and diesel fuel, surging demand, and changes in dietary habits in nations like India and China, the weak dollar, drought in wheat-producing areas like Australia and Europe, speculation in commodity markets by investors concerned about the flagging economy, and policies around the world that have halted the adoption of agricultural technologies that would boost production and efficiency. Of the list of factors, ethanol and biofuels are nowhere near the top. Yet many have chosen convenience over facts in blaming ethanol for rising food prices. They ignore, for example, that ethanol producers are both feed and fuel producers. Let me give you a little explanation of the ethanol production process. We utilize only the starch of the corn that we take into the plant. What we leave behind and we sell to cattle markets, dairy markets, poultry markets, is a very high-value, high-protein feed product. So much of the feed value of the corn that we utilize is still used in the feed complex. I want to focus specifically, though, on the role of oil in driving up food prices, because I think this has been woefully underreported. Because oil has an impact not only on the price of food, but on the World Food Agency's ability to provide assistance to those who need it. Last June, economist John Urbanchuk calculated that rising oil prices have twice the impact on food prices as a similar increase in the price of corn. Since then, informer economics have calculated that rising corn prices were responsible for just 4% of the rise in food prices. Likewise, the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City calculated that a 10% rise in energy prices results in a 5.2% rise in the price of food. I should note that just since the beginning of this year, oil prices are up more than 30%. Most recently, Texas A&M concluded that record oil prices are the driving factor behind higher farm and food costs. In fact, the Texas A&M report went on to note that tampering or removing the federal ethanol policy would have little impact on food or the price of corn. The impact of the price of oil on the price of food is clear. Higher oil prices equal higher food prices. This isn't a hard concept to grasp when you stop to consider all of the oil used to bring food from the farm to the supermarket shelf. The dominant role that oil prices play quickly becomes clear. Farmers rely on oil-based diesel and fertilizer to grow a crop and transport it to market. Food processors must use petroleum products to power the plants, process the food, package the food in plastic, and often transport the food to the store in refrigerated trucks. The reliance on oil-based fuels is also crippling the budgets of food aid organizations. A 2007 GAO report estimates that 65% of the budgets of these organizations is spent on transportation. That report was done before diesel prices skyrocketed, and we're seeing the prices we are today. One tool, indeed perhaps the only tool, that is helping to reduce those costs and thus helping to keep food prices in check is ethanol. An analyst from Merrill Lynch estimates that removing biofuels from the market would result in oil and gasoline prices soaring 15% higher than they are today. According to the Center for Agricultural Research and Development at Iowa State University, ethanol has helped keep gasoline 30 to 40 cents cheaper than it might otherwise be, depending on where you live. Over the course of a year, that means consumers are saving between $305 and $420 because of ethanol. Compare that to the relatively modest impact increased corn prices are having on food inflation, about $9.78 or 19 cents a day, and the importance of maintaining the movement toward biofuels becomes very, very clear. The crises the world is facing today, be they food, economic, or environmental, all have a common denominator, the ever-tightening world oil market. Addressing this issue will require commitment, leadership, and vision. We cannot afford to jettison the promise of biofuels because of the manufactured hysteria of a phony food versus fuel debate. American farmers and farmers around the globe are capable of producing both food and fuel. Thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the pound key. If you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment for your first question.
Support for ethanol thus far, because I believe public policymakers are taking a much more studious look at these issues than just reading the popular media. And they understand that there is far more to do with food price inflation than simply biofuels. They also understand that we have got to do something to reduce our dependence on oil, and the movement toward biofuels is important. They also understand that if we take our legs out from underneath this important industry today, the ability to move forward and build a cellulosic ethanol industry will be greatly undermined. So, no, I don't expect that there'll be an erosion of political support. Will there be some that will take advantage of what is the misperception being created out there and pursue their own political gain? Sure, I'm certain that there will be, but it's our job to make sure that we are correcting that misinformation. That's why we're here today.
Second, I should also know, please use a mic so the folks on the phone can hear you. Let's go right here, please.
Yes, this is Peter Shin with Brownfield, and my question is for you, Rick Tolman, and you, Tom Bias, or anyone else who can answer it, which is, to what extent are the higher prices for raw commodities spurring global production, which, if weather cooperates, will presumably help relieve some of the pressures that are being felt outside the United States?
That's an excellent point, Peter. Farmers respond to price incentive, and there is certainly incentive around the world to produce more grain. I think that most every country in the world, many countries in the world, can produce wheat, and so I think we'll see a supply response for wheat even this year. More countries can produce soybeans. We'll see that as well. There's not as many countries that can produce corn, although we expect to see more corn production out of Brazil and Argentina, as well as here in the United States, to respond to that. So I think that will be a significant factor. And we can. The old adage in farming is high prices are the best antidote to high prices, because farmers produce more, and they can do that.
Good question, Peter. You know, I'm amazed. Just a couple of years ago, the United States and corn production and cotton and many other commodities were being blamed for putting farmers around the world out of business because our prices were too low. We were also being blamed for obesity. Now we're being blamed for hunger. I don't know if we're ever going to win on anything. I haven't found the solution yet.
In the back, standing up.
Thanks a lot for taking my question. I'm Dan Goldstein with Platts. Tom and Rick, I guess you got to get back up again, because this one's for both of you guys. Rick, let me start with you. With $4 a gallon diesel and $6 a bushel corn, at what point does corn drop and diesel go up to the point where it's not profitable to harvest corn anymore, and farmers are going to actually stop producing corn acreage? And I guess, Tom, this question is for you. Are you in line with, I guess, the majority of Democrats who are calling for the president to stop filling the strategic petroleum reserve?
Interesting question. Input prices have gone up dramatically for corn production, not only diesel fuel that you mentioned, but fertilizer prices have doubled. Seed corn prices are up. Land prices are up. Equipment prices are up. Right now, with our productivity and with the higher corn prices, there's still a nice margin for farmers. They can still make a return. Our biggest dilemma this year is not so much the incentive to plant, it's the weather. And if we can get some good weather out there, I think we will see very significant planting of corn across the nation. Corn is right now the most profitable crop that the farmers can plant, and so there's a real incentive to plant it.
The answer is yes, we are supportive of suspending the purchases for the Strategic Oil Reserve, and I would take that a step further. I think the president ought to release oil out of the Strategic Reserve. If you look at what the high oil prices are doing to the economy, it's wrecking it. And on the heels of the mortgage crisis and the credit crisis, we're in trouble. Our economy's in trouble. And ironically, some of the people that are introducing legislation and make a lot of noise about rolling back the RFS come from oil states. And I guess $40 billion a year for ExxonMobil and profits and those record profits aren't enough. If they want to help, let's release that oil. Let's also put a excess oil profits tax on and distribute it to help people that are truly needy in this higher energy, higher food price crisis.
I want to say something on another subject that was asked about before, but I'm thinking about this, and I think it's very important. Higher price food is mentioned earlier, is going to mean we're going to produce more food. But just think of the investment and the incentive now for countries all over the world that have really, first of all, maybe they didn't have the money to invest in their agriculture. Or secondly, maybe they didn't have the incentive. So they were holding to the old ideas that, we're not going to use genetic engineering. That's 20 or 30% increase in production if you could use this kind of new technology. And Europe and Japan have been fighting it, and they've been closing the door on biotechnology in Africa, in many places. You know, Africa, some places there, they don't even have hybrid seed corn. There's a long ways to go to increase production in a lot of countries, and with a little higher prices, which the growers, even in those other countries, are seeing today, they're going to have the incentive and the wherewithal to do something about it. And I think this is a great thing. It's a bad thing in some ways, but it's a great thing for rural countryside and people in these countries all over the world, and the rural United States too, I might add, in the end. May not be so great for my hog profits aren't what they were, but I'm optimistic. A rising tide lifts all boats. We'll all be there.
Alan Bierger from Bloomberg News. When you take a look at global food inflation as well as some of the causes and solutions to it, there is seemingly a difference between ethanol and some of the other factors in that you can't decide, the U.S. government can't decide how much somebody in India eats. They can't decide how much oil OPEC decides to produce. They can waive the renewable fuel standard, which is what a lot of ethanol's opponents are saying should be done. So we've already heard Mr. Bias suggest the Strategic Petroleum Reserve or a windfall tax on oil companies, but I'm wondering what sort of public policy solutions you, all of you, would be pushing for the U.S. government as an alternative, as a way to get people away from the whole RFS suspension debate.
Well, number one, part of the reason we're in this problem with high oil prices and very little production from renewables is because every time we have an oil crisis, and you go back to the Arab oil embargo in the early 70s, we get all ginned up about taking these next steps. Then oil prices come down or something happens and we go back to sleep. This has happened time after time after time. And we didn't get serious about this until the first RFS was passed. I think it would be the biggest mistake for the future of this country to roll it back now to address that. We know how to roll back the oil prices. We know how to help people truly in need. We're about to pass a farm bill, Congress is, that is going to provide $400 billion in domestic and international food nutrition aid to people that are less fortunate. $400 billion. Other countries of the world haven't stepped up to the plate like we have, but I think there's solutions out there, and let's not roll it back. I think Bob mentioned that infrastructure for that next generation of ethanol being produced from cellulosic, for that next generation of all these energy products, corn ethanol is setting the template for it. You know, when we started Gasohol, I think it was called back in the early 70s, right, Mr. Secretary? It probably wasn't energy efficient. It wasn't economically efficient. And the truth be known, you know, the real expertise probably lied with moonshiners who were used to making it in the backyard. But it took 30 years. Corn ethanol is the newest 30-year phenomenon anyone's ever heard of. It took 30 years for us to get there. why we would backslide now would be a huge, huge mistake.
Again, I'm Bob Denis with the RFA. The one thing I would say to those that believe that there's nothing they can do with the rising food prices other than perhaps roll back the RFS or ignoring the fact that the single most important factor driving food prices is oil. So the one thing that we have to moderate oil prices, ethanol, they want to roll back. And it might be good for Texas, okay. It Exxon's profits a little bit higher, I guess, but it would hurt American consumers. Absolutely, the only thing we have to address rising gasoline and oil prices today is domestic renewable fuels like ethanol. And we can't shoot ourselves in the foot. By the way, Texas's own Texas A&M University agrees with that point, that rolling back the RFS would not have any impact on corn prices and would absolutely devastate the demand base for ethanol.
Hi, I'm Bill McConnell with The Deal magazine. Regarding the separate varieties for corn for ethanol and food, isn't it fair to argue that food prices are increasing because land that would be devoted for food corn is being switched to grow ethanol corn?
Rick Tolman from National Corn Growers again. No, that's not fair to suggest. The vegetable growing areas, the areas that grow sweet corn, are primarily dedicated to growing sweet corn because they feed into processing channels that it's primarily grown under contract. It's a whole different seed distribution, marketing, processing channel than is field corn. You know, you don't grow corn just for ethanol. The field corn is grown, and a farmer sells it to whoever gives him the best price. If it's a livestock operation, if it's for export, or if it's for an ethanol plant, and so it's a commodity across those different markets. For sweet corn, it can only go for sweet corn, and that land has a different pricing and generally a commitment level to it than what does the field corn. So they're in general very different categories. Now, yes, land values are rising. You can look at alternatives, but I would find it very hard to suspect that food corn has we've moved away from producing food corn for field corn. That's food corn sells at a premium to field corn.
Let me just make one other point or a couple of other points with respect to some of the food issues that have been addressed. Rice, for example, you don't grow corn in a rice paddy. Wheat, actually last year, wheat acres increased. We produced more corn than we ever have on more acres since 1945, and at the same time, wheat acres were increasing. So there hasn't been this shift that some are suggesting.
In green, right here. Hands in my place.
Mr. Bias, and also others, if you want to. I want to follow up on that solution.
Sorry,
Marianne Lavelle from U.S. News and World Report. The solutions. You mentioned the commodity markets. Now, of course, you know, that's been used by farmers for years. It's important. But what solutions could there be to people go into the commodity markets when the dollar is weak? Is there anything policy-related that can be done?
Well, I think number one, you have to make sure that the policy's in place to prevent speculators from dominating the market. There are speculative limits right now. There's a strong feeling that those have been avoided by some of the more complex trading tools that are available out there. Whenever you have pension funds buying in the Chicago or whatever market, futures market, you pretty well know they're not planning on taking the delivery. That retiree is not going to take delivery of a train load of corn in December after it's harvested. So it's more speculative than commercial. You need some speculation in the market to provide liquidity. But we have seen tremendous influx. And again, you can't blame that on corn. You can't blame that on rice. You ought to be blaming that on the weak dollar. because that's a pattern that's repeated every time U.S. dollar is low, commodities prices go higher. The people on Wall Street, you had the same time, the big index funds, can't make a profit on Wall Street that they could on this hot commodity market. So they're all related, but we have asked for the House and the Senate Agriculture Committees to hold extensive hearings on this issue. Because, very frankly, the answer we got at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission was disappointing to me. We know there's a problem out there, and as I mentioned, it's precluding farmers from being able to forward price their commodities for delivery after harvest. And that's a huge concern.
Let me add one comment to that. The convergence issue is a real challenge also for farmers. Normally, futures contracts and cash contracts come together at the end of the contract period, and that has not been happening. And so it sends a different signal into the marketplace. We testified last week with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. One of our suggestions was that there be more delivery options, more delivery locations, so that there could be more liquidity and more opportunity to deal with it. But as Tom said, it's a real issue for farmers. They see $6 corn, $5.80 corn quoted, and they can't get that price because the local markets are not offering that. They're offering significantly less because of this disconnect that's going on.
In the green tie in the back.
Stuart Darwin with AgriPulse. Question for Bob Dineen. What would be the likely impacts on the ethanol market if Governor Perry gets the waiver? I mean, will, in your view, will blenders, if he gets the waiver, will they stop blending? Will there be some who will continue? Just what do you think the impact would be?
It's hard to tell what refiners would want to do. I mean, they could certainly take advantage of the fact that 4.5 billion gallons of domestic U.S. fuel is not required to be used, and further tighten gasoline markets, further run up consumer prices, or they could, because they need octane and they need fuel supply, continue to use it. I don't know. I do know that it doesn't make any sense from a policy standpoint, and I would hope that the administration, EPA, denies the waiver request.
Steve Cook with BNA's Daily Environment Report. A lot of people are saying that the environmental benefits from biofuels are essentially a wash or maybe even a negative when you consider fertilizer use and new land being plowed up, conservation lands, lands being taken out of conservation, as well as on the international scene, supposedly they're cutting down rainforests to grow oil crops. What is your response to that?
I say that ethanol reduces exhaust VOC emissions and carbon monoxide. It reduces toxic emissions from gasoline, and it is the only liquid transportation fuel available today that is having a greenhouse gas benefit because we are taking CO2 out of the air in the growing of the crops. You're referring to an article that was published in Science Express a couple of months ago in which a lawyer decided to write a polemic about ethanol and how it might be produced in an unsustainable way, and he lined up a bunch of assumptions that as ethanol use increases and increases beyond levels that are allowed in law today, mind you, that it would result in acreage coming out of the rainforest. Well, that's not what's going to happen. It wouldn't be allowed under our laws or the laws in other countries against deforestation. But it created a great deal of interest. Land use issues are going to be an important subject of discussion as EPA continues to promulgate rules implementing the energy bill from last year. And there will be effects. But the effects that were discussed in that science article aren't based in reality, and the assumptions were not at all realistic.
Let me go right here in the white, and then we're going to take a couple questions from the phone line.
Jenny Mandel with Climate Wire. Questions for Mr. Tolman and Bice. You both
talked about other crops and other food prices that are not linked with corn. Are you both saying that there's absolutely no correlation between feed corn prices and other grains in the world markets?
No, I said there is some correlation, there is some impact. It's not to the level that that's being portrayed in the media, and it's not nearly to the level that oil prices have. Now, there's a closer correlation in the United States to corn prices and other grain crop prices. Obviously, wheat and soybeans and corn all compete to some degree for some of the same acres, so they play off one another. But the dynamics driving up wheat prices are very different than those driving up corn prices. The wheat price rise is coming from world shortage, from primarily weather disruptions in Australia. And so independently, those prices would have risen with or without any biofuels market because of a shortage. And so there is competition then. As was said, our wheat acres expanded last year, and this year our corn acres are contracting because wheat acres went up. There is a correlation between wheat and soybeans, and they're caught in the middle. But for rice, no correlation at all. The reason that rice prices have gone up have to do with what you've heard. It is growing demand around the world, and if you look at the major rice producers, there has been a drop-off in yield against trend for the last 5 years, and that's happening in India and in China and elsewhere. The U.S. is a rice exporter, but a fairly minor one compared to the world players, but it has virtually nothing to do with biofuels.
I would just like to add, I think there's this misconception that you're having this huge shift of acreage. You have some. But in the case of wheat versus corn, most of the wheat acreage that's been converted has been converted over the last couple of decades. Secretary Block said the rising tide lifts all boats. Low yields, weather-related problems, and low prices have encouraged farmers to shift to higher-value commodities where they stood a chance to make a price, a better price, or possibly a profit. And you had new technology or new hybrids for corn and soybeans, and so the traditional corn belt has been expanding for decades. I'm not saying there wasn't some shift, but the difference between wheat and corn is you need water for wheat, and most of the wheat is grown in areas where they don't have sufficient water in order to produce a more thirsty crop like corn or soybeans. In the case of rice, as Rick mentioned, the United States produces 2% of the world's rice, and we export one half of that. There is plenty of rice out there. Rice, 90% of all rice is produced within 60 miles of where it's consumed. And so to blame corn for world rice prices is a real stretch.
See if we can make the phone line work. I believe it's Forrest.
Our first question comes from the line of Forrest Walls with Delta Farm Press. Please proceed with your question.
Yes. You've talked about the impact of the increase in commodity prices on food prices. Can you put some numbers on the impact of the increase in oil prices on food prices?
Forrest, this is Rick Tolman, CEO of the National Corn Growers. Some of the recent studies have suggested that the impact of oil prices on food prices is twice what the increase in corn price is on retail food prices. There was an Iowa State study that suggested a 30% increase in grain prices would have a 1.1% increase in retail food prices. The same increase in oil prices would have three times that impact. That's the nature of the results in the studies that I've seen, anywhere from two to three times the impact at the retail food level that grain prices have on retail foods. And again, as Bob so eloquently said, if you think about all the things that transportation impacts, from growing the crop, farmers have to use the fuel intensity to grow the crop, transport it to market, store it, get it to the grocery store. You have to drive to the grocery store to pick it up. Everything that we do is impacted by higher fuel prices.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Your next
question is from Pam Russell.
Lives there in the pink.
Hi, I'm Allison Winter with E&E Daily. I'm wondering with the Farm Bill, what you think the effects on the U.S. ethanol industry would be if it does indeed include the reduction in the blender's tax credit and perhaps the tariff, too.
Again, this is Bob Denny with the RFA. It's important to understand that it is the refiners that get the tax incentive for ethanol production, not the ethanol industry. And we are not uncomfortable with the slight reduction that is being discussed in the Senate Finance Committee right now. And as I understand it, they are extending the secondary tariff on ethanol as well in that package, which we think makes sense. And I'd like to just make a point on that as well. The secondary tariff is there not so much to protect the industry, to protect the U.S. taxpayer, because it is only there to offset the benefit of the tax incentive that's available to refiners, whether that product is imported or domestic. And so we are quite comfortable with the package that is moving through on the Farm Bill.
This is Tom Bias. I would just like to add to what Bob said. This Farm Bill and part of the reduction in the blender's tax credit, it's being used to increase the incentive for cellulosic production to make it more economically viable so that we move to that sooner rather than later. So I think there is significant improvement in the Farm Bill. And for those who don't want to see corn ethanol, they want to see cellulosic ethanol, this will accelerate it.
I'm going to go back to the phones real quick. I think, is it Pam?
We have a question from Pam Russell with Engineering News Record. Thank you. I just wanted to switch gears here just slightly. Since October, a handful, maybe more than a handful of ethanol plants, construction of ethanol plants has been canceled. Veresen said that it was because of the, you know, rising corn prices and the lower ethanol prices. Do you see that this is going to continue? I know that the financial markets are holding off on financing any new plants because of this latest political shift or opposition to more biofuel plants. How do you see the construction of these new plants going forward, and do you expect that this is maybe just a temporary bump, or you know, what will happen with the construction of these plants?
Thank you, Pam. I think this is an example of the marketplace doing what it should do, and looking out and seeing where the economics are today, there's not, it's understandable that there would be some slowdown, perhaps. But I think it's important to put in context. There are 61 ethanol plants that are under construction today that are moving forward, that are pouring cement, that have people on the site, and those facilities are moving forward and we believe are going to be up and running within the next 12 to 18 months. And the industry is continuing to grow and to expand, and the fundamentals in this industry remain extraordinarily strong. So I'm not surprised that there might be a few changes in some people's plans, but I view that just as the marketplace doing what it should do.
And this is Bob. I'm sorry, was it Bob that was responding?
The point I would like to make is that take a look at where we're at in the world today, and the price of energy going up as much as it's gone up, and all the money that we're transferring to the countries that have oil. I mean, listen, this is telling us something in the United States that we probably would rather not transfer as much of our wealth to some other country that may not even be friendly to us. Maybe we could keep some of it here at home. One way to do it is renewable fuels. It's not the only way. We're for all these things. We should do everything and try to find something that works the best. Renewable fuels with corn now. Cellulosic renewable fuels later. Assuming it works, we think it will, but maybe it won't be perfect. And you've got, of course, we've got the wind, we've got the sun. We ought to be drilling for oil in our own land. We're not even doing that. We're not against these other sources of energy. We're just saying let's use all of it because, you know, we don't like to transfer our wealth someplace else. Let's keep the money here at home and keep the jobs here. It's a good idea, especially with our trade deficit the level that it is today.
Time for a couple more. Anyone else? Go here and then come over to you, Jeff.
My name is Michelle. I'm with Executive Intelligence Review. As the problem of pricing, as everybody has been discussing, is actually one that takes a number of considerations into account, I would ask about the policy we used to have of fair pricing, of parity pricing, as opposed to the philosophy of allowing the markets to continue to do their own thing, despite what effects that may have. So I'd like to know where the panel stands on that. But in addition, in terms of the energy question, the best choice is nuclear power. And the fact that there's been a drive to hold back the development of nuclear power for those same 30 years or so, we could have developed enough nuclear power that this problem wouldn't exist at all. And plus, we'd have the ability to create the irrigation for the desalination of the water that would generate much more productivity in the farms to begin with. So, if you could comment on those two things, please.
On the nuclear power question, I was in France last year, rode bicycles for a week, and all were in the Loire Valley. Everywhere you would ride, there's a nuclear power plant there in front of you. And it just made me think, what's wrong with us that we have not done this? Now, we missed the boat. That's another example of things that we should be doing here at home. And of the other things, what was your other first part of your question? Oh, parity and fair. Well, I've lived through the parity stuff, and I think in the end, though, markets override things like that unless you just have a guaranteed price. And you know, markets, you can't beat a market system. High prices encourage production of what you want. Low prices discourage production of what you don't want as much. And I think we just need to rely on markets for the most part. A market-driven economy is what we really have, although we get involved in it sometimes for certain reasons, and usually it's appropriate, but the market itself is what should dictate.
I don't think you'd find a farmer that would turn back a parity price on their commodities, but I do think it would probably set off a firestorm bigger than the one we have if we were receiving those prices. I mean, the highest that any of these commodities has reached in comparison to parity recently was wheat price, and it got up to about 90%, and everyone in the world is screaming about the lack of wheat. So I think it would be a difficult thing to achieve, although, again, there's nothing wrong with a farmer receiving a profit for all their hard work. You know, profit shouldn't be a dirty word only for America's farmers. And I think there's some in this debate that really take that attitude. They want that cheap commodity, yet they want a dependable supply. And somehow you're going to have to get your income. Last 30, 40, 50 years, we've made up for the lack of a marketplace price, except in a few peaks and valleys, with government transfers. Yet for the past year, we've been pounded in the press that these greedy farmers are getting all these subsidies. So somehow we're going to have to get that profit, or you're going to have to come up with another mechanism. And I've never met a farmer that didn't want to get the profit from the marketplace as opposed to the government.
Joe, for the last one.
Joe Kamelick with ISIS News again. Mr. Block, Secretary Block mentioned that we ought to be drilling for more oil domestically here in the U.S. And offshore. I wondered how your three organizations feel about that very issue, because industries outside of yours, manufacturing, chemicals, fertilizer, have been clamoring for Congress to lift the embargo, the moratorium on offshore drilling, for example, for five, 6 years now. Where do each of your organizations stand on the issue of opening up more domestic U.S. Energy development?
Bob Dineen, RFA. I guess I'll just say this. Our nation's energy crisis is so severe, I think it would be foolish to not be pursuing every source of domestic energy that we have. That's been our point. We can't say no to biofuels because it's too important. We ought not be saying no to wind or solar or geothermal or perhaps even nuclear. We need to pursue all of this. If we don't, as a nation, get a hold of our dependence on imported oil and do something very real soon to address $120 a barrel oil, or heck, the minister of oil from OPEC yesterday said that he could see $200 a barrel oil soon, then our economy, our national security, and indeed our way of life is going to be at risk. Ethanol is not the solution to everything. It needs to be part of a more rational, more progressive energy policy that includes all of these things.
Rick Tolman again, National Corn Growers. I would echo Bob's comments. We often hear that corn ethanol is not the silver bullet, and then people go on to calculate how many acres it would take to satisfy all of our gasoline needs. We agree it is not the silver bullet. It's part of the silver shotgun shell. It's one pellet in it, and we need nuclear. We need renewable wind power. We need plug-in hybrids. We need cellulose. We need more drilling domestically. So we're strongly in favor of that. Agriculture runs on energy. We need a cheap, reliable source of energy that's market-based.
I agree with Rick. We need to look at all sorts of sources. My understanding is there's some new technologies out there that are currently at play. They're being able to drill, I forget the term, horizontally up in the Dakotas to get some of the soil. There's a lot of potential ways that we get around this energy thing. But I think the thing that Congress could do and has refused to do so for the past few years is pass a renewable electricity standard similar to the renewable portfolios or renewable fuel standard, because that will send an incentive and a message to the industry to invest. Right now, we have the capacity in wind alone. I'm not talking about the people up there, but like North Dakota is the windiest state in the nation. But we have to be able to send the signal that technology, or to invest in that technology, and also the challenge of how we transmit electricity generated in the rural areas to get it to where the people who live and want to use it. So we're for a combination.
Thank you. I'd just like to add maybe, again, we do need all of these resources. If we allow the current hysteria over this issue, over ethanol, to undermine the confidence that the financial community currently has in new renewable fuel technologies and some of these other future technologies, we will do great damage to those others that are coming along. The ethanol industry today is providing the foundation upon which a cellulosic industry will grow. It'll provide the confidence to the financial community that other new technologies can be successful as well. And if we allow opponents of domestic renewable fuels to succeed by creating this hysteria, then I am very concerned for the future of all those other technologies as well.
One other thing that needs to be mentioned, we need conservation as well. That has to be a component in all this, and the recent passage of a higher CAFE standards, fuel mileage standards, was a step in the right direction, but other steps need to be taken.
This is the last word, I guess. Listen, thank you all for showing up, and I want to say that I was pleased to be here. everybody here from a little different vantage point, but all however, from in a lot of ways the same vantage point, looking out for the country, looking out for the agricultural industry and farming, and to me, having been part of the whole food industry, from the farm to the fork, as they say, I'm for all of it, but we're going to have to kind of make sure we give everything a chance and be even-handed and fair and try to address our energy problems, because I think in the end we'll all prosper. As I said earlier, I think this rising tide's going to lift all boats. We're going to get to a new plateau. We're already up there. It'll come down some, someday it'll drop. But we're not going back where we were. You can't go back where you were before unless you go back to $20 a barrel oil. We're not going back there, and so we're never going to go back to $1.90 corn or whatever. We're going to see a little higher prices. We don't know where they'll settle out, but let the market system work and let the market system decide, and I think we'll all have a good future, and certainly the American agriculture and the whole of the food industry has always done an outstanding job, an amazing job of feeding the people in this country and exporting almost a third of our crop to people all over the world. And I think we're going to keep doing it.
Thank you, folks. That's it.